A podcast of the cinema.
I have an answer to your question.
Oh?
What stage production would I like to see an all-nude version of?
This was a Twitter question, yes. Which one?
A Christmas Carol.
Well, I mean, Marley is wearing a harness, I guess. That's Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duralde.
I have my reasons.
Sure. Nope.
The Ghost of Christmas Present is always this like big strapping dude.
True, with a big beard. Yeah.
Come on now.
That's Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duralde. We're film critics. We're married, and this is our show.
That was succinct.
Yes, thank you.
There's been some pushback lately.
Oh, and now the intros are too short?
Yeah.
Oh, brother.
We can't please anyone.
Clearly. Why do we even bother? We both write for The Wrap.
You do many other podcasts.
I do a bunch of other shows.
You do other projects.
We don't know. We'll see.
Maybe you do another project.
Maybe.
Something. There's always something there's always something percolating.
Yeah. It's true. I'm a tryhard.
Stop saying that. You've said that now twice on the mic, and I'm like, do you know what a tryhard is? Like, yes, you try hard, but you're not a tryhard. Like, that's young people slang, and it doesn't mean exactly what you think it means.
Okay, fine.
So
I know it's not entirely complimentary, and that's why I'm
correct.
Saying it.
No.
Okay,
no,
fine.
You just quit it.
All right. I promise.
You try very hard and you succeed at many things and you make things happen.
Fine.
I'm building you up right now.
Thank you, my darling.
My husband.
I will go back to twerking on fleek then.
Please. Because when you twerk, ooh! Oh, it's on. It's, yeah.
All right, it is Monday morning. Sorry that we're late. And
sure.
I got places to be, so let's just dig right in, shall
He's
we?
A man on the go.
I am.
We're
trying to get stuff done before Thanksgiving. You know how that is.
It's a yeah. I got some. I have my own agenda to do today.
One that you took on yourself. So
it's true, and I'm happy to do it.
Okay,
but AKA not allowing anyone who's coming over to Thanksgiving dinner
to bring anything.
Bring anything. I'm doing it. I'm doing it all. It's a fun project. But that's not really... I mean, if that was everything, like if that were...
Sure, your only responsibility.
If that were my
this
only
week,
responsibility...
you should be so lucky.
But I've got, like, you know, tasks and chores,
yes,
and errands and post office.
Things are due.
Stuff like that, yeah. I have a writing deadline today. Mm. It's so... Listen, it's a topsy-turvy world.
It is.
And... And I'm drowning in it.
Allison Wilmore just tweeted that her brother once told her that she managed to find a way to, like, have homework due for the rest of her life. And that is the job we have taken upon ourselves in the freelance world.
I don't mind that, obviously. I mean, I get to work in my underpants. I don't have a commute.
Sure.
My office is this dining room table. Mm. My recording studio is this dining room table.
And look, for me, frankly, without a deadline, I get nothing done.
That is a fact. I've watched you.
I need the icy breath.
I've watched you flail without a deadline.
Yeah.
And, you know, you wind up playing a lot of whatever that Willy Wonka boing boing game is on your phone. I don't know what that game is.
No, you don't.
I don't want to know what that
That's
game
fine.
Is.
That's fine. You don't have to
It's
know.
It's a game.
You don't need to know.
So, okay, so we have four movies to talk about.
Yes.
We have Charlie's Angels.
Which, for all I know, is barely in theaters anymore.
Hang on. You just hang on with that one right there.
No, that's all I'm saying.
A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Frozen 2.
Yes.
And Dark Waters.
Correct.
The new Todd Haynes.
Yes.
Movie. Do we have any ad spots to do?
We do not.
None.
Week.
Okay.
No.
Well, why is that? Who wants to be an advertiser?
LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com.
Our reach is medium, and you will...
And our rates are exceedingly reasonable.
Oh, they're very reasonable, because we're, as I said...
Our medium reach. We're,
we have a medium reach, exactly. Well, let's get this Charlie's Angels together, because by the time you hear it, it might not even be in a movie theater anymore.
Yeah, like that
we didn't see it for its opening weekend, and we bought tickets to go see it at the Grove. When was it, like last Tuesday afternoon?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And it was us and a very stylish old lady in the audience.
Oh, I didn't see her.
She looked like one of those, like... Okay. Remember that scene in 30 Rock?
I love New York!
That's like very, very, like...
That Francis Lear sort of...
Tall, chic,
uh-huh,
really cool
big
outfit,
glasses.
Big statement eyeglasses, yeah, and stuff. Short, silver...
Right.
Blunt cut,
Bob.
I'm cool kind of hair, even mm-hmm, though I'm 80.
Yes.
That was the lady behind us at the theater.
I was an editor at Cosmopolitan in 1978.
Right.
Yes.
And I every once in a while I'd steal a glance at her every once in a while, and I'd be like, she was into it.
Good.
But it was that was it. It was just us three.
Yeah.
And what that means, you guys, is that no one went to see this movie.
Sadly, no.
And it got a lot of weird, it got mixed reviews.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, trounced. It wasn't like 3% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Sure.
It was a mid-50s mm-hmm, sort of thing, with some critics liking it and some critics not liking it. And I think the majority of the critics were sort of like, some of it's cool, some of it's not.
Yeah.
But then there was a social media aspect of it as well, and that was very strange to look at.
Well, there were a lot of people, I think, who were very quick to sort of revel in its, you know, low box office.
Right, and why?
Because they were trying to connect some sort of dots, like, because this and Terminator Dark Fate both opened weekly. With an A,
yeah.
The idea being the phrase that started bouncing around among certain, you know, internet turds was "go woke, go broke."
I do despise people quite a bit.
Aren't they the worst?
I especially despise those people.
Yes,
and I'm very happy that none of them listen to this show.
Indeed,
and if they do listen to the show, they're very quiet because they never step to me at all.
Yeah,
And if they did, I would ignore them. But like I don't understand how you can take pleasure in the failure of something because
it's not aimed at white guys.
Because it's not aimed at you, like a 17-year-old, you know, insecure.
Yeah.
Heterosexual white boy.
Right.
Like, you know, you do have a lot of things that are aimed at you. You're like, there's all of, pretty much most of popular culture is sent to you on a silver tray.
Yes.
And maybe it's because you're too young to understand that that's the case, but that is the case. And so...
To quote Wells for Boys, this isn't for you.
Right.
Although it is for you. I think a lot of the guys, if they saw this movie, would actually maybe enjoy it.
I think OG Charlie's Angels on 1970s television
uh-huh,
was for them.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. That's a male gaze show. No
that
question.
Was that was a show created for men to look at conventionally attractive women
mm-hmm,
with large breasts.
Yes.
And And I mean, it wasn't jiggled television, that expression wasn't that coined.
Yeah, for like Charlie's Angels and Three's Company.
Yeah. And so I think that the aura of that has always hovered around Charlie's Angels. Hmm. I think even with the Lucy Liu, Cameron Diaz, Drew Barrymore version in cinemas.
Yeah, the McGee films.
I think those straddled the fence in a way between, well, we're going to give you the campy bikini stuff of the 70s.
But with a knowing wink.
But also here's Destiny's Child to sing about being independent women.
Yeah, and Cameron Diaz is going to dance around in underoos to like a 70s pop song.
But now there's a new one, and it's not like that.
Yeah.
There is no... other than the name association,
right?
There is a decidedly, you know, woman on woman on woman on woman on woman sort of vibe about this. Mm-hmm. It's not, if you find these women attractive and you are a person who wants that, then sure. But that person who wants that might be a young woman who wants to go look at
Kristen Stewart. Sure.
Who plays a queer character, like her character, Sabina.
Yeah.
She's a queer character.
Yeah.
And it's very much a cocky, strutting, you know, ladies lady sort of character. Who, if she's talking to another woman and she leaves the scene, her head swings back to give her another look.
Right.
You know, and it's very much like that.
Yeah. Kristen Stewart is amazing in this movie.
I agree.
Like, you know, the last few years has been like, okay, wow, Kristen Stewart is now free of Twilight. She gets to act, and she will act, and she will do it for, like, really interesting directors and do unusual
serious films, serious work. Yeah.
Who knew she was funny?
Well, she's been on SNL and was funny.
This is true, yes. Yeah. But she gives such an assured comic performance here.
Yeah.
And is so game for the kind of physicality of the role. Like, in the beginning of the movie, she literally subdues a guy while doing, like, silk trapeze around him.
Right.
And, like, you know, using these curtains to, like, lash him to a chair and stuff.
Yeah.
I had the biggest grin on my face for this, like, entire movie. I went in... having read the sort of so-so reviews, knowing that the box office was crap, and being like, all right, well, let's see how this is. Because, like, Elizabeth Banks, her other big movie was Pitch Perfect 2, which does not exactly inspire confidence.
Not a good film. Yeah.
But I like the comedy. I like the action. I liked the sort of forward momentum of the story. I liked how the characters interacted. The way that they have sort of expanded the Townsend Agency and the Angels and the Bosleys, now Bosley is a ranking.
Yeah.
You know, into the larger world. There are many of them.
Yeah.
Turning this into sort of this, like, kind of spy caper, which the McGee movies did to an extent.
Right.
Like, they were clearly, like, expanding beyond what the original show did.
Yeah.
I had a blast. I really enjoyed this movie, and I really wish that people would go see it, because it is just goofball fun and expertly crafted as such.
I don't think it's a good movie.
Yeah.
I don't think I don't think Elizabeth Banks is necessarily a good filmmaker.
Okay.
She loves what she's doing. Mm-hmm. She brings projects like this and Pitch Perfect 2 that she's really, you can feel her enthusiasm and commitment to it, but I don't think she's a good filmmaker yet. She might become a good filmmaker, but I don't think she's a good filmmaker.
I was surprised at how well the action was directed. I thought there were several fight scenes that were like, oh, okay. You know, they were
competently executed. Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
but not excitingly.
I felt the suspense during the whole, like, when they're in the rock quarry and Kristen Stewart is fighting that guy in the giant rock grinder.
I know you felt the suspense in the rock grinder scene because you were next to me going, ah, ee, woo, ah, ee. Like, I can always gauge your level of enthusiasm, A, by, as we've discussed on KCRW, how much you are sweating.
I save that for the really good.
You get excited and you begin to perspire, and you've got like on a t-shirt and a flannel shirt, and the flannel shirt comes off, and it's just a t-shirt. And the, but also by your investment in the thing that is absolutely not suspenseful at all. Like, there's not 1 second of that rock grinder scene where I think, oh no, what if one of Charlie's angels gets ground up into pebbles by the rock grinder machine? But... like that, but you give yourself to it. I'm not dissing you here.
Okay.
I'm saying that when you give into a movie and when you invest in a movie, you allow it to put you right in that moment.
Yes.
And I admire that about you because
you have cut yourself off from joy.
I'm removed from these things quite often. And
your whole not being scared by jump scares is extended to everything.
Yeah. Well, I think that there are films that I, you know, respond to by believing in them.
Mm-hmm.
I did not believe in this film.
Okay.
Having said that, I still had a pretty good time.
Okay.
I enjoyed it much more than I thought I would. I went in with absolutely no expectations because of all the negative, you know, vibes that I'd gotten off of it. And the trailer was not interesting.
Mm.
The Ariana Grande, Lana Del Rey, and...
Miley Cyrus.
And Miley Cyrus song, not good.
Blah, 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 Angel.
Yeah. But... so there was the advance stuff coming at me about this film was,
right.
Do I gotta go? Do I have to see this? I don't have to see this. But then I started hearing about all the go woke, go broke. And then I started hearing from queer filmmakers, not queer filmmakers, but queer
viewers,
audiences who were talking about it, that I should see this for Kristen Stewart doing her thing.
Right.
That is totally worth it. Absolutely, totally worth it. And I really did love the surfacey stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I liked their helper, that guy who
yes.
was like, "May I put a poultice on you or whatever?" It's right. Like,
their Q.
Yeah, basically. I liked that guy. I liked, outfits.
Mm-hmm.
Great outfits, great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Yeah. If you're making me a movie where spies go into a giant closet that has all the cool stuff in it, give me this over Kingsman
anytime over Kingsman for sure. I loved the moment that you super loved partly because I love that kind of thing too, but also because I love being near you when you're loving it. Out of nowhere comes a choreographed dance number.
Ah, yes.
Which is a signifier to me of a couple things. One, that we have entered science fiction.
Yes, Cloud Cuckoo Land.
Where suddenly, and with no advance warning that this would ever be part of this action.
Right.
People are all dancing simultaneously in choreographed moves to the same song.
Yeah.
In this case... a real hyped up remix of Donna Summer's "Bad Girls."
Are these Gigamesh? Is that what
I've listened to a couple times Ooh. Since. I'm into it, but watching them all just like, yeah, time to choreograph dance. Time to
5, 6, 7, 8.
Like that's delightful.
We're international spies and assassins, but first a kickball change.
Right. The minute you go step up into. In a film is the moment I think, okay, sure. I would like to see more of this, please.
Yeah.
I had a problem with Elizabeth Banks's wigs.
They
were not meant to be weird, but they were.
Yeah. And she should fire her director for that, but it's her.
But it's her. Overall, there was enough. Again, queer energy going on, mm-hmm. not just from her, but just as like, there's like a vibe of the whole movie that's it's a bit tongue in cheek, not campy, not rooted in the inherent misogyny of the original television right. series.
There are male characters, but they're, I mean, as far as like,
they're fine.
There's
a potential
love interest for one of them who could not be any more on the margins.
And who, what's that actor's name?
Noah Centineo.
Right. And he's,
he's the like, Netflix boy.
He's somebody right
He
now.
Was in like all right. To All the Boys I've Loved Before.
I don't have a good read on him other than, you know,
pleasant.
Mark Ruffalo is looking at this kid going, hey, you just watch your step. Because he looks like baby Mark Ruffalo.
You know, like Fish in the Bathtub era Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah. And the he doesn't have a lot to do other than kind of be a damsel in distress at one point.
Yes, yeah. Totally. He's the hostage.
And I didn't fully love it the way you did, because okay. I could really feel you loving it. But I had a pretty good time, and it doesn't deserve what's happening to it.
No.
There are plenty of crap movies out there that come from big studios with bigger names attached in terms of directors, uh-huh. and bigger everything, that are hits for no good reason.
Or that flop, and nobody says, do we need any more action movies with men in them?
Right.
Like Terminator failed for a lot of reasons that include the fact that no one particularly liked the last two Terminator movies.
Right, right.
You know, it's not...
It overestimated its appeal as a franchise in 2019.
Yeah. You know, and so it makes me insane when, every film that has, where the leads are queer or POC or women or some combination thereof, If they do break out, they're flukes. And if they don't break out, it's proof that audiences don't want to see those people.
Right,
you know?
Right. Anyway, yeah, if you have any interest in this, go see it.
And if it's still showing somewhere near you, yeah.
It's not good, but it's not crap. And there's a lot of fun stuff in it.
Yeah, I think you'll be entertained, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And speaking of... strong female characters, as they call them on Netflix. Frozen.
Let me go. Let me
go. No, that's not it. No.
Let me go from... contractually driven sequels.
Frozen 2. I'm not mad at this movie. I'm annoyed at the idea that... because I guess, animated films take longer to make and there's fewer of them. Like, if the people behind Frozen had made a live action hit, I would think that those directors, those writers, would be like, okay, great. We do want a Frozen 2 at some point. But like, in the meantime, you have proven yourself with this sort of non-IP, property.
Right.
Go wild. Make something else. Like, we trust your judgment. Go do a thing. And then come back and we'll do the sequel because we know that's guaranteed money.
Yeah.
Nope. This is just right into the sequel. This is, that's nice that you made this movie that was a super mega hit and has sold God knows how many soundtrack albums and, like, princess dresses.
Right.
But we just want you to come in and do it again. And doing it again is what they do.
I thought the original Frozen was... a lovely, wonderful film.
Yeah.
I saw it like 2 weeks before it was released. Mm-hmm. And I came home and said, wow, it was like this big old-fashioned musical but it was still fresh and, not that Disney princess tradition.
Yeah.
Was really into it. And then the phenomenon began.
Right.
And I sort of cocooned myself against it because I didn't want to become
burned out,
saturated.
Yeah,
when I say I've only heard that song twice, I mean I've only heard that song twice when I saw it being sung in the film, mm-hmm. and then when Idina Menzel sang it on
the Oscars,
the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
But I also knew this other thing. hearing Idina Menzel sing half a dozen songs in a movie,
mm-hmm.
and hearing Idina Menzel sing the same song again and again and again and again and again out in the world,
mm-hmm.
are two different things for me. She is, as I said on KCRW, I don't know if they left it in, she is the apex predator of this type of singing.
The Broadway belt.
It's more than the Broadway belt. It's a highly enunciated, you know, like, clear, like, shot kind of mm-hmm. voice.
Right.
That too much of makes me feel like I'm being, like,
pummeled,
stuck with needles. Mm. And so... she's a great singer.
Yes. But a small dose of singer.
But for me, a small doses kind of situation. Like many Broadway style, you know,
sure.
anythings. So I closed myself off to the Frozen juggernaut.
Yeah.
And it also helped that
we don't have children.
You don't have children. Yeah. And so it was not difficult for me to do that. And so I didn't burn out on it. Having said that, that sense of discovery, that sense of freshness,
mm-hmm.
that sense of, oh wow, this original thing, you know, obviously based on a
Hans Christian
an
Andersen,
old story,
but very loosely
but one I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
And so,
and it, you know, as with most Disney fairy tale adaptations, something completely different happens in the story.
Right. The I don't care about this perfectly executed piece of, in Martin Scorsese's words, audiovisual entertainment.
Yes.
I just don't care. I'm happy that the children who loved this film and the adults who loved it too get another
helping
of it. It's not my thing.
Yeah, no, I that's basically it. Like, it is beautifully crafted. It looks great. You know, it's mostly set in autumn, so you get a different palette of colors than last time. You know, I think the story tries to do some interesting things in terms of, like, hey, let's address the sins of the historical past, which is
right.
a bold thing for any, like, movie aimed at children made by an American company to do, I think. Even though, and even if they don't take it all the way and they kind of wimp out, they wimp out in a way that Hollywood movies tend to do anyway,
yeah.
wherein, you know, like, for example, in the first Avengers movie, when Robert Downey Jr. is prepared to sacrifice his life to save the Earth by closing up the gap between the whatever and the whatever. Who remembers at this point?
Well, if anyone should, it should be you.
I know. Well, if I don't, forget it.
You're the one who's the nut on comic books.
Anyway. And he does the thing and then doesn't die. Because, you know, we have to have Robert Downey Jr. back. You know? And so, like, constantly you see this in movies where it is set up to where the lead characters are prepared to make the ultimate sacrifice. And isn't that amazing and how powerful that is? Oh, but takesy-backsy. They don't really have to do it. Like, they're going to fix everything and...
Takesy-backsies? Is that what you just said?
Yes.
Thank you.
They're going to fix everything but not have to, like, actually die. And we get that here, you know, to an extent. And it's sort of like, all right. But I can't hate Frozen 2 for doing it because, like, that's a grown-up movie thing, too.
Right.
Sadly enough, these days. Like, you can't... do anything really. I mean, like the most major thing you can do to shake up a franchise is to have, like, you know, at the end of Toy Story 4, like, Woody, you know, making his decision to
leave.
To not go home with the other toys. But, you know, I think it does raise some, along the way, some interesting ideas that parents could certainly talk about with kids. And I've seen accusations that it's a white savior narrative, but I think it's also a white villainy narrative, so
it's about the heirs of white villainy trying to correct
exactly.
the villainy.
Yeah. It's about sort of a post-colonial, maybe, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, there are ideas there to be plumbed and explored, and I would hope that parents would talk about that with their kids.
I mean, let's be real. White people are villains.
Oh, yeah, no question.
In history.
Yes.
Just throughout.
Yes. No question.
Anything bad that happened, white people probably invented it.
Oh,
that's fairly...
We can't take all of the credit.
We can't take all the credit, for every evil thing that happened in the world.
But we've done our more than our fair share, for sure.
Listen, up until about 100 years ago, you weren't even considered white. So
no, but I do come from a race of colonizers, so, you know.
It's true.
There you go. Anyway. You know, but the songs are, like, fine, but you can tell, like, the you know, the first movie, they didn't know what they had, necessarily, so they could do things and try things, and this time, they know they gotta do that again, so.
There was no Frozen Bible.
Sure.
When the first film happened.
But there is now.
But there is now. And, you know, let there be a third and a fourth, because then you'll have all the seasons.
Yes.
You know, fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not mad at this movie. It just doesn't delight me the way the first one did, because it is doing that sequel thing of, like, let's do that again.
Yeah. I assume it made
a
lot of money.
It made quite a bit of money this weekend, although apparently not, like, you know.
Were there projections that it was going to be $500 million already?
Something like that. It didn't quite stack up to certain other animated films, but how dare it. Exactly. It's
you know what's going to happen this coming weekend, though?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's not going to drop off at all.
No.
Because this coming weekend, you're going to have, in the United States at least.
Yeah, Thanksgiving weekend.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5 days in a row of people stuck with their families.
Yes.
And at some point, they're all going to go to the movies.
Right. And the big movies that are opening before Thanksgiving are, or the day before Thanksgiving, are Queen and Slim and Knives Out, which are both very adult-aimed.
Correct.
So, like, Frozen 2 has the whole feel to itself when it comes to kid entertainment right now.
Yeah, that's it. That's the only game in town.
I mean, children. Arctic Dogs.
What's that?
Some crappy movie.
What happened? What is that? Is that a movie I didn't know existed?
It's some cruddy little CG animated film that it was released by Entertainment Studios Motion Pictures.
They're my favorite.
They're my most generically named film distributor ever.
That is an English as a second language name for a company. Where are they based? Are they based in the
here?
US?
That's Byron Allen's company. They're based here in Los Angeles. I know. It sounds like a front somehow.
This is like a money laundering
operation. Yes. Just, I mean, not that it actually is, but just that name is so flatly generic.
I'm sure it's not.
No, it's legit, but it's...
It's the stupidest slash
greatest name.
Bestest name of a company. It's like, when I finish saying it, I can't remember what words go in what order. I have to go look at it again, written down, and go, yes, Entertainment Motion Picture Studios.
No, that's not it.
Yeah. Is that all for Frozen 2?
Yeah.
Are we done?
I think
so. Yeah, I don't... Like, you know, I don't care about much. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Yes.
Is the story of not necessarily all Fred Rogers.
No.
It is the story of Fred Rogers, played by Tom Hanks.
Yes.
Who encounters... a man played by Matthew Reese from The Americans. And that man is a journalist for Vanity Fair.
Esquire.
You sure it's Esquire?
Yeah, positive it's Esquire.
Okay. Whatever. One of those big glossy magazines.
That's still around.
Condé Nast runs. Okay. This character is based on Tom Juno.
Yes.
Who is a well-known journalist and author.
Magazine profile guy.
Yeah, but he's written books, and, you know, he's one of the big names in the business. And he...
of what's left of the magazine industry.
Correct.
Yes.
And in 89, 99? When was it?
90s.
He went to talk to Fred Rogers.
Yes.
And he became the cover story. And... I have not read the original article.
They have sent it to me. I haven't read it yet either.
And so I don't know what the original article is like versus
how the film portrays it.
But in the film, Matthew Reese is a journalist. He lives in New York City with his wife and his newborn. and he has a difficult estranged relationship with his father, played by Chris Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Cooper was an absent father, and then
abandoned the family when the mother got sick.
Abandoned the family when the mother became terminally ill.
Yeah.
And so he's also, although the film never says this out loud, he's also a total alcoholic.
Yeah.
And we are meant at weird moments to think that the father is trying to reform, but I was like, well, until you come to understand that
you are powerless.
You are powerless to in the face of alcohol. Mm. So that was a strange element, but I'll get to that in a minute. The Tom Juno character, Matthew Reese, has to sort of in the process of profiling Fred Rogers for this magazine, he also has to come to some sort of reconciliation moment with his father. So the film is about this guy, and Mr. Rogers is his helper.
Yeah.
In a way.
His sort of mentor of forgiveness.
Now, when I walked into this, I didn't know what it was about at all.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were going to rehash the documentary and tell us all about the life of Fred Rogers.
No, I knew that he was like a supporting character and that it was mainly going to be about the magazine.
Right. Last year, the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor,
right,
came out, and it is all about the life of Fred Rogers.
Yes.
Very cool documentary. You'll learn all sorts of stuff. You should see it.
Absolutely.
Before you see this.
Yes.
So that you can get a better sense of who Fred Rogers was and why. Because if you don't know anything about Fred Rogers going in, you will witness Tom Hanks behaving in a manner that doesn't feel like any normal human being you've ever met in your life.
Yeah, I could see somebody watching this movie and thinking that, like, that this is a character who exists only in the magazine writer's head.
Right, yeah. Like, you could have been, if this were any other movie and the Fred Rogers character were hovering around helping him, you'd think, oh, he's a ghost.
He's a helpful angel.
He doesn't really exist. Like, he's in the guy's imagination. But no, Fred Rogers
there was a real guy.
Was this guy.
Yeah.
And if you've ever seen an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the PBS program for children that he made through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and into the 90s,
yeah.
That dude on camera is the same dude off camera. He was just like that.
Yeah.
And so now you come to Tom Hanks and his portrayal, which is very much like Renee Zellweger in Judy, not going to make you forget the real person.
Right.
But also keeps you going.
Yeah.
Throughout the film. Because he's so disarming as a human being. And he never stops looking at you with those "I care" sort of mm-hmm. expressions on his face. Which would creep you out if someone did it to you in real life.
Not if Fred Rogers did.
But you're thinking, oh, it's Mr. Rogers. I love him so much. You know, it gets me too. You know, like when I was a little kid, I loved Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, me too.
He was quiet and nice and not yelling.
The documentary.
He was the opposite of pretty much any adult or any minister or any preacher at a church that I ever encountered.
The documentary made me weep profusely. This movie made me weep when Tom Hanks was being Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
And I, you know, somebody was saying online, oh, the people who don't like this movie just wanted it to be a rehash of the documentary and be about Fred Rogers' life. Not necessarily.
Right.
And I mean, in a way, yes, I'm glad it wasn't because, yeah, we have the documentary. We don't need that. But I would have liked it to have been about somebody that I did care about, and I didn't, frankly, care that much about the magazine writer and his family issues.
I don't know if, because again, I have not read this article.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if Fred Rogers pushed the forgiveness narrative onto Tom Juno, or if there was even one necessary. But what I do know is that the current contemporary understanding of the nature of forgiveness, the one that we have all come to sort of decide is right, is you should forgive people not for them, but for yourself.
Right.
That no matter what hideous thing they did to you, you know, abandoned you, assaulted you, abused you in any kind of way, that your job as a human being, your journey to becoming a whole person again, is to forgive that person, whether they know they've been forgiven, whether they want forgiveness, whether they have sought forgiveness or not. It's all for you. It's all so that you don't have to be broken. It's so you can have closure. That's the other word.
Yeah.
That's very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's not true. I don't think you have to forgive people who have been diabolical monsters to you. You know, if they have made a mistake and they regret it, and you want to like talk it out with them, then that's an easier kind of forgiveness, and that's something to do. And even if it's a big kind of forgiveness, even if it's a you abandoned me,
right?
And they come across maybe as contrite later on in life, and they've learned or they've changed. Sure, let's talk about forgiveness.
Well, I think the Chris Cooper character,
but it ain't necessary.
No, I hear you, and
to
I
have a good life for you.
Sure,
to go around forgiving all the people who've wronged you.
No, I agree with that, but I do think the Chris Cooper character is at least making an effort for a
sort of kinda at the end when he's about to croak.
Yeah.
This is my big problem with the film.
Deathbed conversions are a thing. You know?
I know they are. My big problem with the film is that Matthew Reese's character is the one that has to do all of the heavy lifting in this forgiving scenario.
Mm.
And I'm like, but you weren't the one that did something wrong. Chris Cooper did all the wrong things, right. And he doesn't seem to act like he cares all that much about the fact that he did all these wrong things. He's sort of like, well, that's just me, you know. Want some whiskey? And I'm like, okay. Now, having said that, I agree with you about Tom Hanks' presence.
Yes.
He's the emotional center of the film.
Mm-hmm.
He's the mystery of the film.
Yeah, because the thing about the magazine profile is you can tell he's trying to like... He's trying to rip the lid off Mr. Rogers, basically.
Yeah.
He's trying to get him to admit that, like, he can't really possibly be this zen in real life.
And kind
in real life. And that people seeking him out to tell him their problems, you know, is somehow a burden on him.
Right.
Like, but Fred never takes the bait.
Right. And so on that level, when I say he's the mystery of the film, this is another little shortcoming of the film's, of the filmmaking, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you the perspective of Fred Rogers as a deeply, deeply, deeply religious man, but doesn't dwell on it.
Right.
But that was the central focus of his life.
Yeah, he was an ordained Presbyterian minister.
Yeah. And they don't deal with it explicitly.
Wife mentions that he reads scripture. That's part of what
he
does.
He prays. You see him praying.
Yeah.
He talks about praying for someone.
Yeah.
But that's kind of it. It's like these little discrete moments of, yes, here's sort of the underlying thing that I have in my life that makes this happen.
Right. It's the Hallmark Channel version of religiosity.
Kinda. Now, so those are my complaints.
Mm-hmm.
But on the whole, I think this is kind of a very beautiful little movie. There are some filmmaking choices that I really love.
Oh, see, there are some I really hate.
I love there's a moment in a restaurant.
Yes, that's a good one.
Where you deal with an entire minute, 60 seconds of total silence, which is something that never happens in movies anymore.
We should mention this is directed by Mariel Heller, who did Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Can You Ever Forgive Me? I'll get to that in a second because I have some ideas about that. There's a moment of total silence. It's a full minute where they are just looking at each other. And every time Mr. Rogers is really kind of like burrowing into a person's, you know, life, other people around begin to sort of, they become enveloped in it. And the lovely part of this is that it straddles fantasy and reality.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know if those people are truly reacting to Mr. Rogers as a spiritual force or as a celebrity.
Sure.
And you don't know if they're even participating in the thing at all, because the minute the moment of silence ends, you pull back and those people
are back in their conversations.
Are back in their conversations. Like, they were never really in this circle of silence and care.
Or that, were they?
Right. Yeah. And so I like that. I like the also the idea of this being the flip side of Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where, you know, you have a person whose life is a wreck.
Yeah.
Who also sort of moves into her imagination to make things better for herself, even though it's a crime.
Yeah.
And here you have a person whose life is fine, but has like a wound.
Mm-hmm.
And also has to sort of take a leap into his imagination, into the land of make-believe with Fred Rogers,
right,
who walks around with a puppet on his hand,
yeah,
even when he's not on camera.
And, let me talk about what I didn't like.
Make his life better that way.
Sure.
So I like that. I'm super into this, except when I'm not.
The choices, there were a couple of choices that really bugged me. First of all, the movie opens with, like, Tom Hanks basically recreating the opening of every episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He walks in, he puts on the cardigan, he changes shoes,
Yes. All
that stuff.
Yeah.
And then he starts talking to us about the Matthew Reese character.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's like,
we're in an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Yeah. Like, I just,
that's the framing of the entire film.
Yeah. And so that put me off immediately. I just thought, oh, I don't care for this.
I was okay with that.
And then also, in keeping with the idea of the framing of the show being the framing of the movie, every time, like, the magazine writer takes a train somewhere or drives somewhere or flies somewhere, they do it like they would do it on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, where it's this, like, toy, you know, a miniature set with models and stuff, you know.
Right.
And I just thought that was too twee for words.
It was. Also, I think it worked.
Where
else are you going to do it if not this?
Sure, I suppose. And I'm sure it will work for some people. I just was put off by those two things very quickly.
Yeah.
And so that made me a lot more suspicious about the rest of the film. However, again, Tom Hanks' performance is unassailable, and I love every scene that he's in. And I just wish that they had crafted a movie that was where he is a supporting character, that the lead had been somebody whose journey meant more to me.
I liked it more than you did, but I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
And I thought the lovely parts worked wonderfully.
Fair enough.
Did I cry? I don't think I did.
I did. Just Tom Hanks talking like Mr. Rogers, I just lost it.
I don't think I did. I may have gotten, like, I was moved, but you know, listen, there was no horse in this movie, so I didn't cry. I can't help myself.
Yeah, apparently not.
You gotta be a horse. Comes back from the war. Comes back to his friend, the boy.
Let war horse go.
I can't. That horse loved that boy so much.
I don't know what creeps me out more, when you do your Purge voice or when you get all gooey about War Horse.
They were such good friends and they loved each other.
I saw 1917 yesterday, which I'm...
Is there a horse?
Well, there's some dead horses, and I immediately thought of you. I immediately thought of you, like, whoa, that one didn't make it home to the boy he loved.
I started following that guy on Twitter who writes the fake blurbs.
Oh.
He wrote two in a row about 1917 that are diabolically funny and completely wrong.
When they have the thing now where like they'll show movies to critics and they'll have an embargo for reviews, but they're like, oh, but social media reactions you can do right away.
Right.
And so
what's his name?
Ben Meckler.
Okay.
I have been abstaining from this because I just find the whole practice kind of icky.
Well, of course, it is icky.
But a lot of people will immediately, as soon as the screening's over, like just rave about it and gush about it. And then they're
on Twitter. They want pickup.
Yeah. All these articles, it has now created an entire like class of entertainment punditry where people just go through and collect these tweets. Oh, look, everyone's raving about this movie, that movie.
Right.
And so this guy, Ben Meckler, Meckler, I think he's been on Who Shot You. He's very funny. Has started.
Were you there when he was on?
You don't
remember a human being that was on your own podcast?
I didn't remember that we hadn't talked about Charlie's Angels yet, and we saw that on Tuesday. So, yeah.
What if he's listening right now and thought, oh, I really thought I hit it off with Alonzo? He doesn't remember I existed.
He's lovely. I just can't attest to anything right now because my head is, in a million directions.
Listeners, he's not lying. His head is in a million directions this morning.
If Ben is listening, my apologies. You're lovely.
Because of a thing that we cannot talk about that might be quite exciting. Yes. And it just happened before we...
And I have a bunch of deadlines that started. So it's just, it's all nuts.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so what Ben Meckler has started doing is when these tweets start coming out, and he has not seen the movie yet.
No.
But he'll write this, like, what sounds like a gushy tweet about a movie. And in the middle, he'll hide a thing that is completely absurd and has nothing to do with the film whatsoever.
Right, right, right.
And he gets pickup all the time. Like, he winds up in these, like, these early reaction articles and from people who are not paying attention.
Right.
Which I just find hysterical.
It's like how back in the 90s, people would call up TV stations and just say, Baba Booey, Baba Booey.
He's trolling. It's great.
Yeah. The new Todd Haynes film is here.
Yes.
It is called Dark Waters.
It is.
Please explain it to people.
So this is, in a way, okay. So Mark Ruffalo plays a lawyer who works for a firm that represents chemical companies.
Yes.
He defends, corporate interests and corporate practices.
Yes.
His grandmother is from a small town in West Virginia, and she recommends to a friend of hers that she go that this guy go talk to her grandson because he's having a problem with the local DuPont plant seems to be killing his cows.
Yeah.
And so Mark Ruffalo starts making
This is Bill Camp.
Did you say Bill Camp? I did not. Bill Camp plays the farmer. He's amazing in this.
I'll talk about it.
Yeah, more on him in a moment.
Yeah.
So, so Ruffalo starts making some inquiries and he's being kind of glad-handed by his contact at DuPont, who's played by Jesus from Godspell, Victor Garber.
Victor Garber.
but he starts realizing that, like, he's not getting the full... That's my go-to. I never watched Alias.
Every time you say that, I just think of him in those
suspenders,
rainbow suspenders, and a Superman T-shirt, and a giant frizzy hair moment. Go on.
Anyway, but realizes that he's being jerked around by DuPont,
mime face paint exactly. and stuff, yeah.
and that it turns out that there are all these chemicals that the EPA doesn't even regulate, that they've sort of left it to the chemical companies to regulate on their own.
Corporations should always self-regulate.
Yes,
you guys.
Exactly. You don't want them tied up in that old government red tape. They'll take care of you. And the deeper he digs, the more he realizes that not only are is DuPont the reason that all those cows are dead, they're also making everybody in the town sick through the water, and that in fact pretty much every single person in the planet has deadly chemicals inside of their body thanks to Teflon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good times.
Tell me what you thought about this movie.
It is
because we sort of don't agree.
Not entirely, no. All right. It is very much operating in a 70s. Here's the thing. It's not a paranoid thriller. There's very few moments where Mark Ruffalo feels like he's in danger. But it is a sort of like shoe leather procedural, you know, where you follow this guy who is who at his own expense and at the risk of the career he's created, becomes the defender of the underdog against the giant monolithic corporation. And I don't feel like this movie is rewriting that script in any way. I feel like I've seen this story told a lot of times over the course of my life and told pretty much this way. It's directed by Todd Haynes and it's shot by Ed Lockman. And there are moments you can certainly pinpoint and be like, okay, that's a thing that they would do. And that's the thing they have done and that they're maybe calling back to. But it doesn't, I don't know. When I see a movie like this and the Todd Haynes is directing it, my thoughts are either this is going to be some weird thing like Gus Van Sant doing that fracking movie where it just, you know, he's doing it because he cares about the environment, but he's not going to do anything special to it. Or he's going to completely like throw out the formula that we know from these movies and do something super auteurist. And I think we get a lot more A than B on this.
As a, you know, huge Todd Haynes fan.
As am I.
I have taken notice of the connective tissue from one film to another. There's Superstar inside Velvet Goldmine.
Sure.
There's Safe inside Far From Heaven. There's so much always happening. There's Velvet Goldmine inside Wonderstruck.
There's Velvet Goldmine inside I'm Not There.
And inside I'm Not There. And what I feel about this movie is like, as I watched it, I kept thinking about Safe.
Mm-hmm.
As though somehow it was the second half of Safe. Not only has he gone back and taken moments of mood and camera shots
mm-hmm.
from Safe, sequences that are almost the same, but thematically, you might as well just call this movie Safe 2, She Was Right All Along.
See, I think what's most interesting about Safe is the idea of it being metaphorical. And so
I know.
But you've always believed that.
But this makes on her this side makes like the metaphorical literal.
Yeah.
And because it is a true story.
Right.
The idea that there's something inside you making you sick, but no one will believe you. It's terrifying. It's a horror movie. This is a horror movie about the monster is inside the house and no one will believe you that it's there.
Right.
You know, and it is standing right there. And the reason no one will believe you that it's there is because the people who are disbelieving you are the people who put the monster in the house. They're lying.
Right.
I felt Todd Haynes's, you know, auteur qualities kind of all over this, but in a very bleak, despair-filled way. I said on KCRW on Friday that this movie was punishing, and I would like to amend that. I would like to change my language, because I don't think this film is punishing. I think it's sort of devastatingly bleak and demanding of its audience. Because one of the things you said the minute we walked out was so many endings. And I agreed with you, but the so many endings
is intentional.
Was intentional. Because every time you thought they had come to a conclusion and that they had maybe, you know, triumphed or won or made some kind of progress, the screen would go black and it would say, you know, 2 years later.
Mm.
and then just more misery.
Yeah, like the DuPont would either renege on a promise, ugh, or they would discover some new awful thing. Like there's one, there is one passage of time moment in the film, uh-huh, that somebody said was even more devastating than the one in, yes, Avengers Endgame.
Yes, yes. The way it looks, Ed Lockman, it has shot this thing like expertly, obviously in close collaboration with Todd Haynes.
Yeah, that fluorescent nausea cam.
But unlike a lot of earlier Haynes' films, where there is visual pleasure,
yeah,
like everywhere you see it,
right.
All you have here is the ability to say, "Oh, look what they did." Like, wow, look what they did.
Yeah.
Because it's either a West Virginia winter with like working class people whose lives are miserable.
Yeah.
And they're freezing and everything's falling apart. Or this wicked, wicked company and law offices where green fluorescent light makes everyone look gross.
Sickly. And
all the guys in suits are all like 58. And have my pattern baldness. Like, you could have just put me in a suit in that movie and just had me sit there at a table going, you know, I like money, I hate people, and I want them to die. Like, I would have been
Ohio Chemical.
I would have been seamless. A seamless addition to that film. No dialogue. Just put me in a dark suit and have me look stern and conservative. Louis Vertel already said to me once, I look like I should be going to a MAGA rally. I think this is a brilliant movie. I think it's a detour for Todd Haynes,
yeah,
but in terms of like what you might have already come to know about him and expect from him,
right,
but kind of also not a detour from Todd Haynes.
Yeah,
it focuses like on the evil of the sort of banal places,
right,
and there's also a usage of a John Denver song here that is completely devastating. You and I have talked about our complaint, the John Denver complaint.
Yes.
We have. In the past few years, John Denver has become a popular music cue.
As a punchline.
Like a needle drop as a punchline in films where people are shooting each other to death and there's some like...
Free Fire.
And the song will be like, you know, some soft little John Denver song.
Annie's song or something.
Yeah, exactly. This one, they play it over just a car driving past places in this town that are all owned and run by DuPont.
Yeah.
And like the name DuPont is on the garbage cans in town. And it's the thing, if you lived in a place like
that, the banner on the playground,
you wouldn't even notice it. You would stop looking at it. You'd stop seeing it. And it becomes part of the atmosphere.
There is a point at which, like, you know, they win in court where basically DuPont has to, they're going to do all this medical monitoring and the town is going to have their blood tested and they basically pay people to come in and do it, you know, and if it turns out they've been exposed to whatever, then they would qualify for, you know, this stuff. And they show this one woman going in with her family. And she was like, well, I mean, you know, DuPont's a great employer and they've really,
Good people.
They're good people. They take care of the town. I'm sure we're going to find out this is nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously that does speak a lot to, I think, a lot of our politics right now, where there's this assumption on the part of a certain element of the voting public that the guy they've got in government is doing the right thing and taking care of them, even though he is clearly not.
Everyone's life is so full of problems already.
Yeah.
Just everyday domestic problems.
Sure.
Things that you need to tend to, things that you have to think about, things you have to worry about. Your kid needs blah, blah, blah. Your husband is blah, blah, blah.
Your aging
parents. Life is hard enough.
Yeah.
Without also thinking to yourself, oh, I have to care about this chemical company that's poisoning all of us. Oh, I have to worry that this corporation that owns this social media site that I'm posting to my friends my puppy pictures on is actually mining me for information and using it to undermine our elections.
Right.
I have to worry about every GD thing in the world now. And the politicians aren't helping, and the corporations are out to murder us, and they dominate and control everything. It would be much easier to believe that the corporations liked us.
Yes.
And were actually wanting to be decent to us. They're not.
No.
They want your money, and they don't care if you die.
Yeah.
And the politicians are in their pockets. And unfortunately, that's what this movie's about.
Yeah.
It's not going to be an easy sell.
No.
Especially if you go to the movies and you're like, I just want to be entertained. Well, this ain't it.
Yeah, this is not escapism.
This is a bitter, cold, frightening horror. This is a horror movie. And
this is the movie version of the line that Edward Norton has in Fight Club about how the car company does the math to figure out how many people have to die to make a recall worth the money.
Right.
Writ large.
Yeah. Anne Hathaway is great. Anne Hathaway's always great.
She is.
Small role, but she's working it. Oh my. The wig moments in this film.
There is some wig happening for sure.
She's a trooper.
Yeah, it is architectural. she is also like a lawyer herself.
Yes,
who left it to raise kids. So she has conversations with Mark Ruffalo where she gets it. She knows what's going on, and even when they have disagreements about his commitment to that versus like his presence for their children, she even says at one point to Tim Robbins, who plays Ruffalo's boss, like, "Don't make me the wife here."
Right.
And the movie doesn't make her the wife.
Todd Haynes is too smart for that.
Yeah. This is the second film that he has not written, or third. Did he write Wonderstruck?
I don't think he did.
He didn't write this one, and he didn't write Carol.
I don't have that information in front
of me.
But
anyway,
Mark Ruffalo is so beaten down in this movie. His performance is this absolute, like, I'm just hanging on.
Yeah,
to keep going.
He's
with
doing
this project.
He's doing that thing that charismatic movie stars do when they're playing non-charismatic non-movie stars.
Slumps,
yeah. Like the posture. He's like, he juts his chin out to make his neck look like it's wobbly. You know.
And then there's Bill Camp.
Oh my God.
Who, if I'm gonna put, I'm gonna put him on my what's that? What's the? I keep. I'm sorry. Star.
Star League,
Star Child. We've done 4 ad spots for this guy, and I can't get the name right, and I apologize. This man deserves a Best Supporting Actor nomination.
It's pretty great.
I also want everyone to know that if you think you're going to impersonate my voice, and you're going to do it the way Bill Camp speaks in this movie, you are wrong.
The Star Draft.
Star Draft.
League. You have to create a league in your Star Draft. Sorry. TheStarDraft.com.
TheStarDraft.com. He's going in my league.
There you go.
He is the furious ball of righteous
rage.
Energy and rage. And like that's this side of the Tasmanian devil in the old Bugs Bunny cartoons. Like that's his voice.
The West Virginia version.
Yeah. It is this movie's great. And I will fight anybody.
It is not what I expected that it would be, but I mean it is absolutely worth seeing and
it ain't fun.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, it ain't fun at all.
Yeah.
But I felt like the wind had been knocked out of me. Not because I was surprised.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've seen 70s activist cinema before. I know what this is. But it's just... Dude,
just
those guys are... everyone.
Your periodic reminder that we're all doomed.
Bad people are in charge, you guys.
Yeah. There was somebody who pointed out recently, that basically like... how in the two generations since World War II, we've just managed to really destroy everything.
Pretty much. Yeah. All right, so we do not have time for letters because you have to run off.
Yes.
To go do breakfast all day. Yes. You guys are recording more episodes today.
Yes.
Unlike
at Christy's house. Yeah. Well, because of the holiday, we wanted to get last week's TV out of the way.
So, but we will be back on Sunday of this week. Yes. I mean, it's Thanksgiving weekend, but we're still going to do a show.
Yes.
And we'll get your letters. We'll do letters then.
We will.
And, take us out.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks, Blue, for our theme music. You can follow him at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia, to see what he's up to. We have a Patreon page.
Dude, yes.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Oh, hey.
We have extra shows that we do.
I would like to say a little thing to the people who are Patreon members already. Are you at the $12 level? Are you at the $16 level? Are you at the $20 level? Then you get a prize. And if you haven't gotten your prize yet for 2019, and you would like that prize to be the Linoleum Knife Christmas tree ornament
for this holiday season,
I am shipping them, a lot of them, out this week when you tell me that that is what you want. Now, $1 people, $4 people, $7 people, I love you. You don't get a prize. You get other things, but you don't get a piece of merch in the mail. And if you are $4 and $7 now, but you used to be 16 earlier in the year and you had to downgrade, you still get your prize, especially if you didn't get it earlier in the year. So, you know, you get the thing. But I'm sending out very specifically the Christmas tree ornaments this week and next to the people who want that. My email is dlelandwhite1964, dleland, L-E-L-A-N-D, that's my gorgeous middle name, White, dlelandwhite1964, @gmail. So, contact me. Tell me, I want my Christmas tree ornament, Dave White. Help me out.
Also, a quick reminder, if you're in Southern California, Christmasland Experience is coming up December 15th. I will be there. I will be selling and signing copies of my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. I'll be hanging out with the Deck the Hallmark guys. Come say hello. Get your tickets now at ChristmaslandExperience.com. You can subscribe to the show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. We will read it on the air. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. Listen to the other shows that I always tell you to listen to, but I am in a hurry, sadly. So we'll get to that next time. Anyway, thanks for listening. If you're a Patreon supporter, thank you for being that. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Hope it's delicious and safe and as argument-free as humanly possible. And we'll see you next time. Until then,
goodbye.